Racist dwarves, guns, booze, a whole lot of drugs, and it could all be found in a little tourist trap called Bruise. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, senior editor for Creative Screenwriting Magazine, and today for our Q&A we have with us screenwriter-director Martin McDonagh to discuss his new film, In Bruise. On a side note, Mr. McDonagh is a heck of a playwright, so if you have a chance, take a look around on the internet, Amazon, etc., etc. You could buy his plays. You might be able to find them at your local library. But the guy's got a knack for dialogue, so it's definitely worth checking out. And of course, don't forget to check out the latest issue of Creative Screenwriting Magazine. You could find it on newsstands in Barnes & Nobles and Borders in the United States, Canada, and Western Europe. So check it out now. And of course, you could find out all about what's in the latest issue by visiting www.creativescreenwriting.com. But now, without further ado, let's jump right onto the stage of our sold-out screening right after I introduce screenwriter-director Martin McDonagh to talk about his new film, In Bruise.
Thanks, everyone.
We always start with breaking in stories. Your brother, John Michael McDonagh, is a playwright. I think he...
Screenwriter, actually.
And a screenwriter, too. Was he writing plays or was it only
screenwriters? No, I just stuck to the easy shit. He went in for the for the films from the start.
See, I started off completely inverse. Because you're the playwright.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of your plays. I love Pillow Man. I love The Lieutenant of Innsmore. Yeah. Talk about your decision. But he started before you, right?
So yeah, yeah.
Talk about your decision to also take a career in writing.
Well, yeah, we were living in the same house. Obviously, my mum and dad moved back to Ireland around the time that I left school, 16. But he was upstairs writing, and I was downstairs writing. I kind of took his lead. You know, we both were into films really strongly as kids, I guess. Never theatre. But he had like shitloads of books, and we watched loads and loads of films together. But he started, and then I thought that seemed like an easy job, and I started too. But it took a while. All that stuff was, you know, from 16 to maybe 19, 20 was kind of crap. But crap kind of slowly getting a little bit better, dialogue-wise and character-wise. And then I tried radio plays and things like that. But
your radio plays were never produced, is that right?
There were a few in Australia because I basically had sent them to the BBC and Irish radio, and there isn't a tremendous market for radio plays anywhere. And that they rejected every single one. There were 22 of them. So I remember sending them to ABC Radio in Australia and said, if you don't like them, just throw them away because I can't afford the postage to get them back. You know, I was on welfare at the time. But they said, we like them. We want to put two on this year and two on the following year. So that's kind of cool. And that was my first ever check from writing. It was like 565 quid.
And what was the name of the play that was the first produced?
That was called The Tale of the Wolf and the Woodcutter. It was a kind of a play on Red Riding Hood and all that stuff.
What year was that?
Maybe 94 or something like that.
And then it was the late 90s that your plays finally started appearing in Britain.
Yeah, well then after the radio plays and all that shtick, I kind of tried stage plays. And I think I'd learned so much in that intervening 10 years from, you know, 16 to 24 or so. I developed something. I developed dialogue and character, and throughout all the rejected stuff, you know, there was a lot of good stuff in it. But when I tried to write plays, I think it all just fell into place. It all kind of clicked. Maybe because I was never brought up on plays and never had much of an affinity for them. I kind of hated most of the ones I ever saw, apart from a couple. I saw American Buffalo with Pacino when I was about 14 or 15, and it still sort of stands as one of the best ever. And another one called Killer Joe by Tracy Letts when I was about maybe 20, 24. But then it all kind of clicked because I was writing for an art form that I didn't especially respect that much, and I wanted to change. You know, I wanted to shake up a little bit.
You did shake it up. I mean, most of your plays, to my knowledge, when you first submitted them to the theaters, were originally rejected because they were a bit too in your face. Is that correct?
Not really. I mean, that was more the radio plays. But by the time I started sending off the stage ones, it took a long while to get them to read them. But it all kind of happened kind of fast after that. When I was about 24, 25, I sent off kind of in that year. I wrote maybe 6 or 7 plays, and they all were kind of produced over the next 2.
I saw a statistic that not since William Shakespeare has any playwright had 4 plays on stage in the West End at the same time.
Yeah.
Your plays really took off when you started to.
My ones were good though.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. But of course, touche. Why when you started to do your transition to film, did you not decide to adapt one of your own plays?
I just completely don't believe in that. I think it's just done for money. There's a reason for a stage play to be a stage play. Also, I think if you know that it's going to be the final, if that's going to be it, it's going to be a stage play. You're going to try and make it the best possible stage play that you can. You're going to make it as visual as you can. You're going to, if there's a gunfight in it, you're going to have it be the best gunfight on stage that, you know, anyone's seen. You're not going to think, we'll kind of half-heartedly do it and save it for the movie. I've always had that philosophy from the beginning, and I'm going to stick to it, I think.
Speaking of gunfights, Six Shooter was your first short film, which also won you an Academy Award for Best Live Action Short Feature. Congrats on all that.
Thanks.
Talk about how that project came about and working with Brendan Gleeson in that.
I think I just sent it to a couple of the companies. It actually took a while to get anyone to say that they were happy with me to direct it, I think, because I hadn't directed on stage before. But we raised the money, got a couple of producers involved, and got it to Brendan, and he liked it a lot, and we worked. It took about 6 or 7 days to shoot in the south of Ireland on a bloody train, which is never a good idea. Don't ever set anything on a train. There's just nothing visually you're going to get out of it. Maybe an Oscar, but... But who needs that shit? But that was good. I mean, just working with Brendan was brilliant, and just getting my foot in, putting my toe in the water, and trying to learn the process, to learn a little bit about storyboarding, and just the whole the setup of making a film. Although it wasn't as happy an experience as this, I just kind of felt like I didn't step up to the plate enough, and I didn't take as much control over all of the elements that I should have. I was kind of shy about the whole process, and shyness is fine, and you think it's a good attribute on a set too, but you kind of, there are certain wars that you have to fight and be prepared to stand up for yourself, and I kind of let Brendan do a little bit too much of that on the short. Well, thankfully he did, but on this I kind of led the charge myself.
You did okay, man. You got an Oscar. You
Thanks.
Did okay. Where did you get the concept for Bruges? Hitman in Bruges, where did that come to you?
I went to Bruges like on a little weekend trip from London, where I live. You can get the train to Brussels and get a little train up. I didn't know anything about the place. I heard that it was pretty, but I wasn't kind of prepared for how beautiful and cinematic and otherworldly, medieval and gothic the place was. So I was walking around and going to all the museums and the churches and all that, and was kind of, just stunned by it, and just wondered why it had never been used on a film before. But then by the middle of the second day, I was bored out of my head because there's absolutely nothing to do. So I just wanted to get drunk and anything, meet women, anything. But that became kind of the two sides of my brain talking to each other and arguing with each other, which became Brendan's character and Colin's character. You know, one guy who just wants to drink and get away from the place, and one guy who, you know, loves the art. But then I thought, why would two guys be in a place like that when they didn't have to be? And naturally, I thought, hitmen. hitmen escaping something horrific. And when all of those things came into play, it kind of wrote itself in lots of ways.
Sorry. One of the things that really woke me up in the movie that I thought was like, you know, you think you've got your thumb on the heartbeat, and then there's just this great change when you learn in flashback that he killed a kid.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's very comedic at first, but then you balance drama and comedy really well there. Where did that idea come about, and how did you decide to structurally put it kind of, you know, middle of the first act rather than the beginning of the movie before they leave London?
Yeah, I'm not sure. In some ways, I guess I wanted to almost set up a stock, generic, almost Hollywood-like fish-out-of-water hitman scenario for like the first 15, 20 minutes, but then take it to a whole different, more interesting, kind of sadder, more despairing place. But I don't know, that stuff usually kind of comes naturally. I guess I had the idea of them being hitmen, and then it's just kind of a timing thing. You don't want to give away everything too soon, you know.
Talk about your process when you sit down to write a screenplay or even a play. Do you outline it first?
No, never. Just let the characters talk to each other, you know, and just kind of try and follow on, and then little details will come of things that will happen maybe 30 minutes in or something like that. And then maybe you'll know there's a big thing that's going to happen like 20 minutes in, like the shooting here. But it's for me, it's kind of a natural process of just creating extra characters and just making sure that the details of those characters will come back towards the end. You know, if there's an offstage character, it's kind of like there are no offstage characters. There are no small characters. Everyone should kind of have a purpose, and it can be simple. It can be just bringing them back for the punchline of a joke, but it kind of, like the ticket seller, for instance, in this, you know, you could have just gone to a different character and anything could happen.
So do you map that out in your head? You do that without an outline? You just kind of remember, bring that guy back?
Yeah, if you're just rereading like your first 10 pages and there's a gag about a ticket seller, when you get to page 50 and you're thinking, well, there's another conversation I needed with someone here, you think, why not, instead of bringing in a new character, just go back to the ticket seller?
Sure. Makes sense. Mm. How many hours a day do you write when you write?
Not a lot, really. Maybe three.
How long did it take you to write In Bruising?
5 weeks. 5.5 weeks.
Wow. That's pretty fast. How happy were you with that first
draft? Was it a competition? Yeah.
How happy were you with that first draft, or was it something that you rewrote?
I don't really like doing second drafts, so I was very, very happy. It saves a lot of time. Just get it right the first time.
I mean, why not just carve it in stone, you know?
But, when I'm writing, I'll go back and, you know, that's almost like a process in itself. But I write in pencil on a pad, and then when I type it up myself, and that's almost like a second kind of thing in some ways.
Okay, the transition from handwriting to the typewriter.
Yeah,
okay.
It feels almost like a second draft. If it flows, it'll go in, and if it doesn't flow, it'll kind of jump out as not being, you know, the dialogue. If it flows, it will just go naturally in. But this, I think, I went back to it like after a year, and I think there was two drafts, maybe, and then just little changes, because originally they were London gangsters, yeah. But then when the possibility of working with Colin and Brendan came up, I kind of thought, I kind of didn't want anyone doing an accent. You know, a foreign accent, and it seemed ridiculous to even to have two Irish guys there and make them do English accents made no sense to me. So and the change actually wasn't as great as I thought it would be. I literally had to change like 20 words because I think in some ways the London working class idiom isn't too far removed from the Dublin working class idiom. It's just, I think, when it gets to like a posher, more upper class kind of thing, that the differences really come in. But I think it was cool. It kind of almost added an extra little frisson that they're Irish and their boss is English, and that antipathy was kind of useful.
What do you do when you get writer's block, if you get it?
I don't really get it. I mostly kind of am not writing. You know, if you're doing something for 5 weeks a year, my thing over the last few years is just to write a new thing a year and get a new thing produced somehow, whether or not it's this play or a film. So then, like, because I used to feel guilty about not writing all the time, about wasting my time and, you know, getting drunk and hanging out. I don't feel guilty about that anymore because I made this rule.
You should.
Yeah. But making this rule of just do one new thing a year and leave it at that, and then so if it takes 5 weeks, you've got 47 left to hang out. Yeah.
That works. I like that habit.
It's math.
I like
great
that habit. What was the toughest scene? What was the scene that you found yourself kind of a little puzzled on coming back to?
To write?
Yeah, to write.
I don't know. Honestly, this one flowed really naturally. When you got a couple of voices in your head and they're just bantering away, there wasn't. I guess maybe the saddest scene, but I don't think it was hard. But when you know, after Brendan tries to kill Colin and that whole scene afterwards, I guess my natural tendency is towards humor and black comedy. But to try and write something a little sadder, it's kind of hard to see if you've got it on the page. You know, I think it's like Colin brought all of that out of it. But you don't really know if a sad scene works when you've written it. I don't. You know, you can see if these lines are funny. You know, if it's a funny scene, you can judge it yourself. But sadness and despair is kind of a harder thing to get your a handle on. Sure. You need great actors to be able to bring that out. But even the comedy, you need great actors to do that too.
Well, interestingly, I mean, this is an action movie, but I mean, there was a love triangle in here between the guys. They say they I mean, Ken and Harry and Ray, they all have a deep, earnest friendship and kinship for each other, and especially, you know, a loyalty to Harry. Mm. How conscious of that were you? Because it really pops forth, you know.
I think
in the third act.
Yeah, to be honest, I think the actors brought an awful lot of that to it. You know, I think the relationship between Colin and Brendan really just came off the page because of who they are. You know, they kind of always wanted to work together. They always had a tremendous amount of respect for each other, but they never got a chance to until this. But they're just fun off stage, really. You know, they're just a laugh, and I think that kind of comes through. There's something kind of palpable, but that you kind of knew that they get on, even when they're bickering. You kind of know that off stage it was kind of cool. And Rafe brought, you know, a tremendous amount of intensity. And but yeah, like for me, all three characters are men of honor, and their moral codes are kind of completely skewed in one way. But they do have a sense of honor that they can't be that won't be changed.
You touch on an interesting social issue that's, you know, becoming a big problem here in L.A. The burgeoning race war between white dwarves and black dwarves.
It's an issue. I'm worried.
Where did you get that idea? Because it's so random in the middle of the movie. I love it, but it is such a random
rant. I just like random shit in everything in play everywhere. It will just set something up in... I think you set up a character, and then like halfway through you kind of... Like the Jordan Prentice character, Jimmy, the dwarf actor, I kind of wanted to go into that whole idea of, you know, what's it like to be a dwarf actor? You're getting all you get is elf roles and munchkin roles, and wouldn't that piss you off? Wouldn't that turn you to coke and hookers? But that's almost like a kind of a PC kind of thing in some way, is it? I don't know. But it's kind of but then you that would have been making him too worthy. So then you throw in like this kind of left field ball that he's actually a racist
crazy
too, yeah, or at least went on coke. So it's
racist dwarves are a huge problem here in LA. I'm glad you
everywhere.
Yes, everywhere. Your dialogue is fantastic. Do you have anything specific to your process for writing dialogue? There's a lot of repetition in your plays. There wasn't as much in the film, per se.
Yeah, I don't know. It's certainly something I've never analyzed. I think just there's years of writing the radio plays kind of...
Do you talk it out as you write? Do you record yourself?
No. But, I mean, when it's good, it's like you're copying down two people who are talking. But I don't really analyze it. I don't really think about it too much.
There's a thematic in some of your previous works of dead kids. I mean, especially in Pillow Man. You know, there's an innocent cat that was killed in Lieutenant of Inishmore. Talk about that thematic, because it does kind of creep back in your work, some innocent bystander or creature being killed.
Yeah, I don't know where it comes from, really. It's not. I don't think it's deliberate, but I mean, it's just a simple one. It's, if there's something innocent that dies, you can't really... It's setting up something that you can't argue with, you know. I mean... and you know, the killing of a kid, like in this film, there's no way that, you know, if it was a guy that, you know, if he shot a guy, you know, another priest or something, there could be, you know, circumstances where you could say, okay, maybe you wouldn't feel as guilty. I never feel as guilty when I'm killing priests as much as I do when I'm killing kids. But it's like inarguable. You can't really, you just have to, it's something that a character would have to deal with, and there's no arguing with the killing of an innocent. So I guess that's where that comes from. But again, I don't really analyze that stuff too much, and I don't, probably didn't even notice that there's a lot of dead kids in both Pillow Man and this.
There's a lot of dead kids in Pillow Man.
Is that two?
Yeah, you're right. The third isn't actually dead. But they're talked about a lot.
True.
A lot of page count to dead kids. Moving forward. Because I know we're limited on time. How hard was this for you to set up and shoot? And what was the biggest lesson you learned as a first-time feature director?
Strangely, like, the setting up of it was surprisingly easy. Agent sent it away to a few film companies, and there were like three who wanted to do it. So this was before Colin or anyone else was involved. It was also before the Oscar nonsense happened too, so I was kind of glad that it was pure and simply about the script. So in that sense, it was kind of much easier than it should have been. And the second part of the question was...
What was the most important thing you learned as a writer-director on your first feature during this process? Because it was all new to you. I mean, yeah. You did a great job.
Thanks. The biggest thing I realized is that it wasn't as scary as I was terrified going into it. But it wasn't as horrific as I thought it was going to be. We had 3 weeks rehearsal before we started in Bruges.
Which is rare, actually. How hard was that for you to get?
Easy. I mean, I said from the start that that's what I wanted, and it all just worked out somehow. So we spent pretty much three weeks, just me, Brendan, and Colin in a room, talking about the script, analyzing it, reading it over and over.
Were there any big changes during that period?
No, none. No.
It's good.
I think there was a comma.
All right. Commas are good.
Yeah.
Kind of like a pause.
I like
in the
a
speech.
Nice comma. Yeah. I think what I did realize was surprised that I'd never directed a play before, but I'd always been in the rehearsal rooms before, and I think I realized that I had learned a lot that I didn't know about. I like actors. I knew that anyway, but I realized that I can explain, you know, why I wrote a line or why a character is behaving the way he's behaving. My job mostly on this was just to, you know, hire some good actors and have a good script, hire some good actors and not get in the way of the two, you know. So I certainly didn't bring anything to Colin's performance or Brendan's or Rafe's, apart from insisting on the lines being stuck to and just not getting in the way.
Couple quick questions before we turn it over to the crowd. What was your budget? What was your schedule?
$15 million. 7.5 weeks, I think.
Okay,
then solid. 3 weeks rehearsal on the front of that.
There's a great piece of dialogue that ends the film where he's saying, I hope I stay alive, I hope I stay alive, and it just cuts to black, which is a great ending. How far in your process were you aware that that was going to be your final moment? Because it's a really good final moment.
To be honest, there's a whole extra scene after that, and I knew
Please,
that...
Please, wait, what is it?
I'm not going to go too far into that, but it just didn't work. It was just crap,
Wait, people could learn from these lost scenes. We write about them in our magazine. Are you sure you don't want to tell us anything?
No.
Okay.
But then, like, everything leading up to that, even visually, was pretty much as this ends. But that whole kind of voiceover at the end, it was all in silence. So I knew there was obviously there'd been the voiceover at the start, which was always there. And I saw it could be wrapped up with a voiceover at the end, and it could still work as a film, but I didn't know what that would be. But it was only through the editing and finding like more and more of the story coming through that I realized that the place that Colin Farrell's character had come to would allow him to be in that place. You know, I wanted something that was kind of funny, but still kind of dark, and maybe kind of suggested the hopeful journey that he'd ended up
on. He's searching for redemption.
He has kind of changed, I guess. The original ending, he was still in a darker place and he hadn't changed. But I think through the editing of it and through just seeing his performance come out of it, I realized that there was more hope to it than I'd originally written. So that's what I wanted to capture in that final voiceover.
Did you find yourself in editing deleting a lot of scenes, or was it pretty much as you wrote it?
Yeah, quite a lot. There was like the original first cut was like 2 hours 20, and this is 1 hour 40. So there was a lot of just extraneous. There's a lot of backstory to sort of the priest stuff and the Harry Ken dynamic and the wife and all those things. But I felt they just slowed everything down. There was probably more of the love interest kind of thing with Clemence and Colin. But then I realized the love story was pretty much about Ken and Ray, so I kind of tried to focus more on that.
That's great that you realized that in the editing room, because you know a lot of people, their script is funded, they want to keep it the way it is, they're not smart enough to edit it.
I think it was just that Brendan and Colin's performances I felt were so strong that anything else would be kind of taking away from that in some ways, you know.
Last question before we turn it over to the crowd. It's always got to be a tough one. Suspension of disbelief issues. I love the concept of him jumping off the bell tower to deliver the gun. But 12-story fall, the brothers talking a little, telling people where things are. Was that always
Brendan is a big guy.
Big guy?
Yeah. He's got real strong legs. He works out.
That's a fair answer. Let's turn it to the crowd. You, sir, in the front row. What was your relationship with your DP, and how did that evolve from your work on Six Shooter?
I was a good relationship. Igel was great. I saw a film that he made called Wisconsin Death Trip a few years ago, and I was really kind of loved that a lot. Yeah, it's beautiful too. Check it out if you can't. It's like strange black and white thing. It was great. We talked about every single scene. I storyboarded an awful lot for like 2 or 3 months before we started shooting. So we'd talk those things over. Every morning we'd go get a coffee and sort of analyze those storyboards and sort of decide if we were going to go that route or not. But it was good. It was nice. I mean, this sort of, apart from working closely with the actors, it's the most important. It's almost the only thing that you got to get right, you know, as you know. It was nice. It was cool. I think he did a brilliant job.
Another question from the crowd. Right there, you, sir, in the middle in the blue shirt. Question was in regards to what made you decide as a writer to go direct it, as it being a final revision of directing it.
I mean, I know, like we all know, how screwed over writers get in Hollywood if they don't have a chance to take care of their script. I had a script just prior to this one, which I was going to kind of give over and just hang out on the set and learn as much as possible. That kind of fell through, and this was kind of already gearing up to go after it. And so that didn't happen, and I felt like I've got to jump in. I mean, I was terrified, but it was something almost like a dream as a kid just to even make one film. Like Terrence Malick was always one of my big heroes, and just the idea of just making one film or even two films and walking away was just like so romantic and a perfect idea in my head. So with me, it's just like, just leap in, just, you know, I'm secure in kind of being a writer, but you know, leap into the unknown, you know, face new challenges was what I was thinking, I guess. And I've always kicked myself if I hadn't taken that leap, you know, even if it turned out to be appalling, at least I'd have done it, you know. And right now, you know, it's the whole journey's been such a good one, and I'm so kind of happy with it that I think I could possibly do it again in 5 or 6 years.
I certainly hope so. You sir, over there. Question was in regards to growing as a writer over a 10-year period. Are there any lessons learned that really helped you in your journey that you want to share?
Well, I guess sticking to it, just keeping at it, ignoring rejection. Ignoring rejection, but being completely honest with yourself. And if it's crap, admit it. And if it's really, really good, admit that too. And don't listen to anyone who's telling you not. You know, be wary of giving it to friends.
Why be wary of giving it to friends?
Well,
like, do you not? Like
they're not. They're not the writer you are.
Do you not like taking notes or hearing feedback or?
I always wonder why. Who is this person who's giving me notes? You know, what the fuck have they done? Basically, some employee of a film company at best. So no, I mean, but in the focus we're behind this, I never got one note. Yeah, but that was a smart move on their part.
Yes, it was. Last question, because I know we're limited on time. There's a strike on. How's that affecting you? Your first film is coming out in the midst of it. What's it like on the other side of the pond with the WGA strike?
Over there isn't a strike going on. It's just
over here.
What
are your thoughts?
I'm completely behind it, of course. Everything I've written has been on spec. I don't really get involved with film companies anyway. So, as a person, I'm not actually affected, but I completely support it, of course.
Do you know what you're doing next? What your next project's going to be?
I've got two scripts good to go. One I like a lot, but I'm honestly going to take a year or two, just travel and grow up a bit, and probably write a play this year too, if I've got a spare week. And just grow up, just step back from all this for a little bit. I'm really happy with this, and I just want to see how it goes. But I'm not really rushing in. I've never seen any of this as a career move. I just want to tell some stories, but it doesn't matter if that doesn't happen for another couple of years. There's an older play of mine that we're going to take around Ireland a bit and probably bring it to New York towards the end.
Which one?
Cripple of Inishmahan. But we haven't really gotten that. We had a version of it in New York, which didn't really satisfy me. It wasn't really as kind of dark and bleak and edgy as it should have been. So we're going to try and get that right. And I've got this play in my head that's been bubbling around, so I'll do that somewhere too.
Does the play in your head have a title?
Kind of. I don't want to say that one because I haven't even written the first page of it, so it's kind of... I've got the film. This is one called the film scripts. Seven Psychopaths is the next one I'd be doing.
I like
it's
that
a
title.
Romantic comedy.
And what's the other one? You said there were two film projects.
Suicide on Sixth Street.
Almost like Pick Up on Saturday.
Another romantic comedy, strangely. Yeah, Pick Up, yeah, that's... Okay, yeah, I ripped it off. Okay, yeah, thanks.
Good stuff. I'm very impressed with your film. I can't wait to see what you do next. You've been very generous with your time. Give it up again for Martin McDonagh.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Thanks again to screenwriter-director Martin McDonagh for spending time with us to talk about his new film, In Bruges. If you dug this episode of the podcast in general, consider tossing a virtual tip into our PayPal virtual tip jar by visiting www.creativescreenwritingmagazine.blogspot.com and look for the PayPal icon. Your tips are appreciated and definitely help out with equipment, hard drives, and all the other stuff we need to keep this podcast running. Of course, feel free to check out my blog, which I even manage to update on the rare occasion that I have time to do so by visiting www.jeffgoldsmith.blogspot.com. You can also always feel free to drop me a line by emailing me at yo.goldsmith@gmail.com, and I'll do my darndest to get back to you as soon as I can. Of course, don't forget to click that subscribe button in iTunes or your podcatching software, because that's how episodes are downloaded automatically every time you click refresh. And if you have a minute, feel free to leave us positive feedback in the iTunes Music Store or at podcastalley.com. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, Senior Editor for Creative Screenwriting Magazine, thanking you again for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.